You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the controversy surrounding President Trump, a Navy SEAL, and the newly ousted Navy Secretary has drawn a lot of attention to how the president and the military work together. We'll get the latest coming up. Right now, there's been disagreement in the state capitol over how much political opinion should guide what lawmakers do. Governor Tony Evers has urged the Republican-backed legislature to take up issues that polling shows have broad public support, things like Medicaid expansion and gun reforms like universal background checks. Republican leaders have resisted that, saying that decisions shouldn't be based on public opinion polls. Earlier this month, three Democrats introduced a resolution called the Wisconsin Direct Voice Amendment that would let citizens pursue legislation through statewide referendums. Gary Hebel is a Democrat representing the state's 46th Assembly District, which includes Sun Prairie. He's backing that resolution. Representative Hebel, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Well, you and your colleagues, a couple Democratic colleagues, are backing an amendment to the state constitution that would give the public some legislative power, and you've got some other things that you've worked on. What kind of changes are you looking for here?
Well, what we have, Rob, is called Assembly Joint Resolution 32, and it has three elements to it. The first element of it deals with the citizens of Wisconsin. If they want to introduce legislation, they can do that by way of doing a ballot initiative if they have 6% of the folks that voted in the last gubernatorial election. In this case, that would be 157,163. So roughly 160,000 people sign a petition to have legislation go into effect that they believe is appropriate. If they do that, we have that many people sign, then it can go to the general population for a vote in the next general election. And if it has a majority passing that, then legislation that's proposed would become law. So that's one possibility. Now, there may be a situation where we want to do a constitutional amendment to change things. For instance, we may want to have a constitutional amendment that calls for independent redistricting so that it's not done by the majority party in the legislature, but it's actually done by an independent body based on independent lines. If we wanted to do a constitutional amendment, my bill would call for requiring 8% of the citizenry to sign a petition, which would be about 210,000 people, and they could sign that petition, and the same idea would occur. Now, with the constitutional amendment, that certainly has more authority and is much more difficult to overturn. So it requires more people to sign on to that petition. But again, it would require a majority of the population to, at the general election, vote in favor of independent redistricting as opposed to the gerrymandering that currently goes on.
Now, historically, I want to jump in. Historically, Wisconsin hasn't had these kind of voter referenda except to approve a constitutional amendment that was already passed by the legislature. Why now? Why do you want to make these changes now?
Well, I really think that our legislature, not only here in Wisconsin, but the Congress nationally, is just not responsive to the needs and requirements and the wishes of the people they represent. And I think we derive our power from the people, and the people should be the ultimate deciders of what legislation we pass, and we should take action that represents the interest of our constituency. That's not going on right now, either at the state or federal level. And unfortunately, we're doing very little in this legislative session to carry out the needs and wishes of our citizens. Whether you take expansion of Medicare is a perfect example of where we should be using those funds, the federal dollars, to supplement our state funding needs for health care. And we're not doing that at all. And the citizens of Wisconsin, that is over 70% of the people in Wisconsin want Medicaid expansion. Our legislature has just turned a deaf ear to it for several reasons. One is because of the gerrymandering. There's no contested races to speak of. Most of them have been relegated to the legislators picking who they want to vote for them, as opposed to the constituencies decided who their representative is. And that needs to change. And that's really the main function of this legislation, is give the power back to the people. Let them decide. If they can't elect their legislators, at least let them decide what legislation should be presented and approved by the citizens of Wisconsin. And I think that's a way around the current melee that we're having in the at the state level.
As we wrap up, Republican leaders who have a majority in both chambers have not been warm to this kind of idea. Is this just kind of symbolic, given that it's probably not going to pass?
It's not surprising that we have no warmthness from the Republicans on this, because, frankly, power is intoxicating, and they have the power, and they've had the power. And you can see now that many of the decisions that they make are inaction rather than appropriate action for the benefit of our citizens. They don't want to lose that power. And unfortunately, my legislation would give the power back to the people. They don't like the sounds of that. But frankly, that's what a democracy is all about.
Representative Hebel, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Have a nice Thanksgiving.
Representative Gary Hebel is a Democrat from Sun Prairie. He talked to us about proposals he's backing that would let the public pursue and pass state legislation through a referendum. Mordecai Lee joins us now, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee and former Democratic state lawmaker. Mordecai, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob.
Well, let's start with the philosophical level, the idea that, okay, we should let the people decide directly on key issues, or no, they've delegated their power to lawmakers, let's leave it to them to do.
Well, this is an argument that's been going on for a good 250 years here in the United States. In the sense, if you go back and you read the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, this is odd to say, they did not believe in democracy. They believed in a Republican form of government. In other words, they wanted to insulate the elected officials and the Electoral College from the public at large. And so that's why we saw that it was state legislatures who selected U.S. senators, why we had the Electoral College intervening between the voters and electing a president, things like that. So a Republican form of government doesn't necessarily mean democracy. Now, of course, we're dealing with Republican lowercase r and democracy lowercase d. I mean, going back to ancient Greece, their big intellectual breakthrough was you didn't need to have a king. You could have self-government by the people, or in those days by men, often, you know, the rich men or the property-owning men. And that through some mechanism, they would select the governors, and through some mechanism, they could reject the governors. And that's really where republicanism came from. It's only in the last sort of 100, 150 years in America that we've shifted from that old-fashioned republican form of government to direct democracy, going increasingly towards direct democracy. And so Representative Hebel is really sort of articulating going even farther in that direction.
Now, before we get to his referendum idea, I want to listen to a couple of competing views from a couple top figures in the state when it comes to how responsive politicians should be to polling. First, here's Governor Evers announcing a special legislative session to deal with gun reform.
We're going to start with the bills on which we can all agree. 80% of Wisconsinites support universal background checks and extreme risk protection orders, including those who are gun owners.
And then here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, speaking on Central Time earlier this month.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We don't govern by polls. I mean, they're an indicator, but the only poll that really matters is the one on Election Day.
So how closely, Mordecai, should state lawmakers be looking at polls as representative of what their constituents want and then vote accordingly?
Yeah, you know, this is sort of there's a range between having elected officials who aren't responsive at all to public opinion to abolishing elected officials. And there's a really good example of that, and that's Switzerland. Switzerland has a really weak executive branch. Almost everything goes to a national referendum. In fact, I think it was a couple of years ago, one of the referenda was on should they permit minarets in Switzerland. So everything is decided by the voters. And, you know, coming a little closer to home, California is famous for its propositions that so many major public policy issues are determined by the voters directly. And I guess I tend to be a bit on the conservative side, lowercase conservative, that I more believe in the delegate approach to government, the Republican approach to government. We elect people on a standard kind of schedule and timetable. If the voters don't like what they did, the voters can turn them out of office. In Wisconsin, we even have recalls where you can recall them even before there's the regularly scheduled election. I'm really not sure that having initiative and referendum, going the California or Switzerland route, is really good government.
But is it an argument to say, hey, state lawmaker, 80% of people support policy X, it therefore behooves you to pursue that policy without a formal referendum process?
Right. I mean, it's a good argument to use, but do we really want elected officials to be putting sticking their fingers up in the air and checking which way the wind blows? What's the Bob Dylan line, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows? If that's what we want, and without being facetious at all, if that's what we want, we really should abolish the legislature and go in the Switzerland route. If we want people trying to cool the tempers of public opinion, then we want a more delegate form of government. I mean, I remember voting against public opinion in my district. It was back when I was in the state assembly, and the proposal was to increase the drinking age from 18 to 19, and everybody except 18-year-olds was in favor of it. And I voted against it, and, you know, I was like the only one who voted against it. Had there been an election the next day, I would have been wiped out. But by a year later, sort of public opinion had cooled. It wasn't the driving issue.
We're talking about the role of public opinion in our state government with Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you think public opinion should matter to the people making the laws in our state? Do you think the legislature pays too little attention to public polling and public sentiment, however you want to measure it? Would you like to see a formal mechanism, some kind of referendum where voters can bypass the legislature to try to get things passed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Mordecai Lee, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, looking at the role of public opinion in our state government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think lawmakers pay enough attention to public opinion? Do you think they should be paying attention to what polling says on particular issues? Would you want to see Wisconsin do what some other states do and have a formal referendum process where voters can make laws no matter what lawmakers want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Crandon. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Hey, how you doing? Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely that they should be taking the people's voices into consideration quite a bit more than they do. And I also believe in, yeah, there should be referendum, absolutely. As a one case in particular, marijuana legalization. Medical marijuana, decriminalization, legalization. I'm tired of seeing Scott Fitzgerald constantly, when they ask him that, say, no, no.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Mordecai, what do you think?
Well, Kevin's point of view is as correct as my point of view. In other words, there is no one single correct answer about this. This just really reflects one's view of the philosophy of government. And certainly people like Kevin, about the issues that he's concerned about, are frustrated by the legislature. But on the other hand, if the shoe were to be on the other foot, would they really be feeling the same way? I think it's interesting, and maybe this is just trivia, but Wisconsin does have a referendum process. It was enacted by the progressives back about 100 years ago, but it only applies to local levels of government. And so there can be initiative and referendum for, if I recall correctly, counties, municipalities, and maybe it's school boards. It's very rarely used, and maybe that's an indication that it's not as sought after as currently based on a couple of very distinct issues.
Thanks for that call. Now, we heard some from Representative Hebel earlier saying the system is kind of broken when it comes to lawmakers' response to public opinion. He said because of gerrymandering, the way district lines are drawn, he says it can make a majority party less susceptible to public opinion. What do you think about that?
Well, there's no doubt that he's right factually. Certainly, I think we as citizens, I think the good government answer that I would support is nonpartisan redistricting commission, so that practically every assembly district and every Senate district, and for that matter, every congressional district, is as 50-50 as it can get. So there's no guarantee that a Republican would win, no guarantee that a Democrat would win. I think that would lead to moderate, responsive, open-minded legislators. But the question is, how much do you want to tinker with laws about referendum for that one single issue? I'd suggest listening to Representative Hebel's discussion of the constitutional amendment that he's proposing, that maybe we would need a higher percentage to have a statewide vote. You remember when there was the recall against Governor Walker? It was much more than 150,000 or 210,000 signatures that were necessary for a gubernatorial recall. Maybe we should permit initiative and referendum, but only at these higher levels so that it's really the extraordinary situations.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hello there.
What did you want to bring up, Kay?
Well, it was actually just brought up. My point was that I believe because of gerrymandering, we have people in office who are not necessarily would be voted in if we got rid of, if we did some redistricting, and then those public opinion of polls wouldn't be as necessary. But until we get rid of gerrymandering, I believe the public opinion polls should be paid attention to.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. So, Mordecai, there's a paradox. If a party comes into power, gerrymanders themselves in a way to stay in power, it's hard to do it forever, but it can make it very difficult to change those district lines if that party keeps staying in power. And this can happen with Democrats in some states and Republicans in others.
Absolutely. And the recent argument is that the power of computers to create these districts so that even if, let's say, 60% of Wisconsin voters in assembly elections voted Democratic, that the Republicans were still the majority in the assembly. I think that's a very compelling argument. Nonetheless, I think we have to be cautious about public opinion. And I'll tell you a piece of Wisconsin trivia. Right after the Civil War, there was a constitutional amendment in Wisconsin to give African Americans the right to vote. And it passed the legislature. The referendum went to the voters, and they rejected it. Now, when we look back on that, my God, right after the Civil War, the white voters of Wisconsin rejected voting rights for African Americans. We're appalled by that, but that's what public opinion was at the time. Public opinion isn't always right, either at that moment or historically.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, looking at the role of public opinion in state government. Back to your calls now. Sierra is with us in Eland. Sierra, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Sierra?
Definitely. I wanted to say that it's our representatives' job to respond to those polls by reaching out to their constituents specifically and giving us those avenues to respond directly on action items and things that we would like changed. So they should definitely be paying attention and using their seat to solicit feedback on those issues and to know where they stand.
Sierra, thanks a lot for that call. That's interesting, Mordecai. Do we have mechanisms in place, enough mechanisms, for lawmakers to genuinely have that kind of dialogue with their constituents?
Well, I think the distinction is between a self-selected audience that has a high interest in a certain issue versus the public at large. And as a legislator, I heard from lots of constituents on lots of issues. They usually were self-interested in something. They would benefit from something, or they were ideologically against something. Probably the classic issue that I think we should mention for phone callers like Kay or Sierra is the issue of abortion. Politicians generally have very strong feelings. They're either pro-life or pro-choice. They feel it very strongly, regardless of public opinion polls, regardless of voter preferences. And many of them are willing to sacrifice their careers if it came down to a referendum on that issue. But nonetheless, abortion is only one issue of thousands that legislators vote on. And so these referenda bring into pressure that single issue versus all the issues they vote on.
Thanks for that call, Sierra. Michael on Facebook writes, there's got to be a balance. The public doesn't always know all the details surrounding an issue, nor do they always know what's best. So that might be an argument for leaving more decision-making to the people who are closely involved, the lawmakers themselves.
Well, I've got to tell you, in confirming what Michael's impression was, in my freshman term in the state assembly, I used to, you know, read every bill that was going to come up for a vote. I used to read the committee record. You know, I of course read the mail from constituents. I talked to my colleagues. It was a learning process. By the time I was in my second term in the state senate, I had sort of mastered some of those issues and was sort of more comfortable making faster decisions. And so what Michael is talking about is a sense of expertise that legislators develop over time.
Let's bring on another caller now. Bob is with us in Sparta. Bob, hello.
Hello. We can agree that people in cities have different wants and needs than people in rural areas. And so a statewide referendum or a poll-driven government would just knock us out of the, us people in the rural area, just knock us out. We just don't mean anything.
Bob, thanks for the call. That's an interesting point, Mordecai, that I hadn't thought about. Less populated areas might have unique needs that wouldn't be seen to by the majority of the more populated areas.
Well, that's a wonderful argument. I'm glad that Bob raised it. The counterpoint, of course, would be currently we as the voters vote on all constitutional amendments in a referendum. And so Bob's point about the rural residents of Wisconsin are a minority of the total residents of Wisconsin, in a sense, applies to every constitutional amendment we voted on in the last 20, 30, well, actually the entire existence of the state of Wisconsin. And so at some point, majoritarianism, I think, dominates. The question is, in how many situations do we want majoritarianism, I can't even say it.
That's hard work.
to always be the final decision maker.
Thanks for that call, Bob. And Mordecai, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, a former Democratic state lawmaker. He was with us to talk about how much public opinion does and doesn't matter in state government. We also heard from Assembly Representative Gary Hebel from Sun Prairie about a plan, a bill that would bring referenda into statewide politics. You can still let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, President Trump intervened in a disciplinary proceeding for a Navy SEAL. That move ultimately led to the departure of the Secretary of the Navy. We'll get the latest on the story and what it means for military discipline in the U.S. Armed Forces. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, it's road salt season, but the salt that helps clear the ice can hurt our lakes and rivers. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the latest research on road salt in our waterways and alternative ways to help keep roads safe. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a Navy SEAL demoted for a breach of discipline will be allowed to retire this weekend with his original rank and membership in the elite unit. And a planned disciplinary hearing for him will be scrapped. The controversial case involving Chief Petty Officer Edward Eddie Gallagher caught the eye of President Trump, who took to his defense and demanded the SEAL retain his rank. The case led to the firing of Navy Secretary Richard Spencer over the weekend. The controversy surrounding the case and Trump's involvement highlights the role of the president as commander-in-chief and how the armed services take orders and cues from the White House. Nora Bensahel is a visiting professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. Nora, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a little more about the backstory of the Navy SEAL, Petty Officer Gallagher? What was he accused of doing that led to this court-martial?
He was accused of several different war crimes and was tried in the military justice system in a trial that was very complicated and ended up in charges of prosecutorial overreach. Nevertheless, he was convicted of one charge of the seven that he was charged with for posing with a corpse of a captive. Because of that, even though he was cleared of the other charges, President Trump decided to intervene when the Navy decided to demote his pay grade and his rank and to reinstore his rank so that he would retire at the rank that he was when he was charged of these crimes. What generated great controversy, though, was he is a member of the Naval Special Forces, which are known as the SEALs. And the head of the Naval Special Warfare Command decided to convene a board to examine whether he should be allowed to retire with the trident. That's the symbol of the Navy SEAL community. And it was that that caught President Trump's eye again and resulted in the latest dust-up about whether he should be allowed to retire with that or not.
That's that particular case. Big picture, what authority does the American president have when it comes to overriding military disciplinary decisions?
Well, it's very clear that he has the authority to intervene in cases of military justice, just as he does in the civilian justice system. The president can pardon whomever he wants in either the, you know, civilian legal system or the military system. But he does have the right also to give specific orders as the commander-in-chief about administrative issues. So no one is challenging the president's right to have done this, to have intervened in the case of the Trident. What has become very controversial, though, is whether he should have done so, because that kind of administrative hearing is traditionally the purview of senior military officers who are charged with maintaining the phrase good order and discipline. That's one of the things that they must maintain within their services. And the reason why there has been so much military pushback against this is I'm not aware of any case where the president has dived in so deeply into the administrative procedures that military leaders use to ensure good order and discipline in the ranks.
I want to hear arguments on both sides of this. First, from the president, he talked about Gallagher's case yesterday. Here's some of what he had to say.
With Eddie Gallagher, you know that story very well. They wanted to take his pin away, and I said, no, you're not going to take it away. He was a great fighter. He was one of the ultimate fighters. Tough guy. These are not weak people. These are tough people. And we're going to protect our warfighters. And I've been given a lot of thank yous.
And then Navy Secretary Richard Spencer, who was dismissed, we'll get into that in a bit. But he talked to CBS Evening News this weekend following his dismissal. He said this case sends a bad message.
You can get away with things. We have to have good order and discipline. It's the backbone of what we do.
So protecting the warfighters versus the need to protect good order and discipline in the U.S. military, Nora.
Well, Spencer is right that good order and discipline is absolutely essential for the command chain of command to function. Trump's argument is undercut by the fact that most Navy SEALs disagreed with his decision on this. There have been members of the community who have been very outspoken and members of the military in general who have criticized the president for interfering in these administrative proceedings. Gallagher is very unpopular within the SEAL community because his fellow SEALs believe that the things that he did were against the code of conduct of the moral, the honor and duty and discipline that comes with being a SEAL. And so, President Trump does describe him as heroic and a warfighter. His colleagues don't view him that way. And at the end of the day, former Secretary of the Navy Spencer is right about the military's need to be able to ensure that it administratively punishes those who do not fit the template of good order and discipline in the ranks and seek to undermine it.
Talking to Nora Bensahel, visiting professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University, about the president intervening in a few cases, actually, of military discipline in the U.S. military. Let's get in now to Richard Spencer, as you say, now former Secretary of the Navy. It gets a little complicated, the circumstances leading him to, he didn't really resign. He put in a thing acknowledging his dismissal. Can you lay out how that all played out?
Yeah, it's not entirely clear, as you said, exactly what happened, other than the fact that Spencer is no longer the Secretary of the Navy. The reporting so far seems to indicate that Spencer was working directly with the White House to come up with some sort of deal whereby the president would not intervene in the process of reviewing whether Gallagher should keep the SEAL Trident or not, but that he, Spencer, would guarantee that Gallagher would continue to receive it. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper apparently was not aware of this, although Spencer says he told Esper's chief of staff. And because Esper and reportedly also chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, were trying to work with the president to avoid his interference in this process, Esper was very frustrated that Spencer seemed to be going around him straight to the White House and undermining the deal that that Secretary Esper and Chairman Milley were trying to work with the White House. So ironically, it seems as though Spencer was fired by Esper not for what he was trying to do substantively. In fact, what Spencer was trying to do would have predetermined the outcome, but for going around the Secretary of Defense, who thought that he was working with the White House directly on a solution to avoid any White House interference at all.
Why would it be so important to, I guess, anyone in the chain of command to not have this direct intervention from the White House?
Because the military feels strongly, and Secretary Esper was reportedly agreeing with the military on this, that there be no political interference in what was considered an administrative matter. Again, the president has the authority to do so as the commander-in-chief, but in doing so broke a lot of norms about where political interference, how far that goes down the chain of command. And again, what this was a routine administrative hearing. This was not an official, a case under the military justice system. The military believes that it should have the authority to prosecute administrative issues without political interference, and that's why there was so much pushback to try to get Trump to change his mind, even though everyone acknowledged that he had the authority to do so if he wished.
And President Trump also has pardoned a couple of other service members. In one case, it was someone who was awaiting a trial. Another, I believe, had already been convicted. How does that fit into all of this?
Well, it's part of a larger pattern of the president intervening when he believes that the military justice system either isn't taking fair account of what he considers to be the actions of warfighters in the middle of combat. You are right that he did issue two pardons, and the one that was more controversial was the one where the case of an Army major who had not gone to trial yet. I'm not sure that there's a precedent either. Again, there's no one questions the authority, but I don't think there's a precedent for intervening in the trial of someone in the military justice system who has not yet been through the full legal process, had not yet been convicted. The other one was less controversial for the mechanism of intervening. You know, people can debate about whether he should have been pardoned or not, but, you know, that was the presidents have done that before, and that it was seen as, you know, consistent with previous precedent.
Compared with militaries around the world, what generally is the reputation of the American military when it comes to having a well-disciplined personnel?
The U.S. military is seen worldwide and by its own leaders and by its own service members as being extremely well-disciplined. I can't tell you the number of military officers and retired personnel who have pushed back very hard against President Trump for intervening in this way because they believe that it undermines the ability of the military to, again, to keep that good order and discipline and make sure that its personnel, when they are, even when they are in the worst elements of combat, adhere to the laws of armed conflict and to all precedents about how you treat, what is considered permissible conduct on the battlefield. Each of the people who have been charged in these cases and that Trump has pardoned, or in Gallagher's case, restored his rank as well, are considered cases where, by the military people, where individuals acted way outside what they should have done according to the expectations of service members. And that's why military people have been among the strongest critics of these cases.
We're talking to Nora Bensahel, visiting professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. She's with us to talk about the role of the U.S. commander-in-chief in light of recent controversies surrounding the president, the military, and a Navy SEAL, and other interventions by President Trump into military discipline. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's decisions here? If you are a veteran, have served in the military yourself, what do you think about how all of this is going? How and when should the president get involved with a case like the Gallagher case, if ever? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the controversy over Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher, which now involves the president and the newly dismissed Secretary of the Navy. Our guest is Nora Bensahel, visiting professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. When, if ever, should a president intervene in cases of military discipline? Is President Trump making the right decisions here? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I believe President Trump was well within his rights to intervene. He is at the top of the chain of command in all military branches. When you join the military, and like I was, President Trump was at the very top of your chain of command. He has the authority to intervene at any time if he feels that he has to. And it's a lawful order that he's done. He ain't doing anything unlawful. So I don't see anything wrong with it. And the military has falsely accused Navy SEALs in the past for prisoner abuses and dragged out massive trials on countless occasions. So they're not always a perfect justice system either. So if he feels that he had to intervene, I'm all for it. I'm fine with it.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. So Jeremy's saying, hey, the military justice system can get things wrong. And you made the analogy with the pardon system earlier. It's there, I guess, for the president to say, hey, you got this one wrong.
Yeah, that's right. And Jeremy is exactly correct. No one is disputing that the president has the authority to do what he did. The question is whether it was wise and whether it undermines the military's ability to ensure good order and discipline among the ranks, to self-police on what it considers very essential issues about maintaining the proper behavior on a battlefield. That's what's in question here, not whether it was legal or not. Of course, it was a legally constituted order that the Secretary of Defense then duly followed. I should also add that this administrative hearing about whether to take away the Trident or not is not unique to Gallagher. This is a routine administrative thing that happens and has happened quite a number of times in recent years. The special operations community as a whole, not just the Navy SEALs, but the special forces of other services as well, have had quite a number of disciplinary and order problems that the individual services are trying to address. So this is not unprecedented for Gallagher to have been facing this kind of administrative hearing. In fact, many SEALs who have not done the things that that Gallagher was convicted of have also undergone such hearings and had their tridents taken away as well for things that were of far less serious consequence that did not involve the military justice system at all.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Madeline in Green Bay. Madeline, hello.
Hello. Trump, he was never in the military. He was a draft dodger. And he doesn't think that he should be held accountable for anything that he does. And so he wants to make it so that our military is also not held accountable for things, what they do. And we are becoming a nation that is becoming dishonorable. And if we want to be a honorable nation, not a dishonorable nation, we have to hold our people accountable.
Madeline, thanks for the call. So honor and accountability, Madeline's talking about, Nora.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern about that, again, because the behaviors that even the one that Gallagher was convicted of does undermine the ability of U.S. military forces to conduct their operations effectively and in accordance with the rule of law. And that's why these cases have been so very significant.
Thanks a lot for the call, Madeline, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Nora Bensahel at Johns Hopkins University about the power of the president and interventions in cases of military discipline. Nora, I think underlying some of this is an attitude from President Trump and many others that, if we hold too closely to these rules in war zones, we might be tying the hands of our military officers and enlisted folk. This is actually hampering their ability to effectively pursue America's military goals.
I have never heard a single military officer espouse that view. In fact, when they talk about this publicly and privately, they are far more concerned that people who do things that are not in accordance with the laws of war on the battlefield undermine the entire U.S. military, not just credibility, but its ability to execute its orders. It is precisely in the situations where there's the chaos of the battlefield, where things are complicated and where death and destruction are all around, that you want people's training to take over, to use force only in the way that is authorized by their commanders. That gives them plenty of opportunity to conduct operations, and if there are problems with specific commanders doing so, that can work its way up the chain of command. But no military officer that I have ever spoken to or heard of has ever articulated the view that the president has on this.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is on the line in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I kind of find it interesting because it's sort of a violation of the military discipline when I hear things about colleagues of this individual talking badly about him, you know, outside the ranks. That's sort of something that you are drilled in the military. We were all drilled that that's not something that you do. So I'm always concerned about that because it seems like this ends up casting the entire system, you know, into a bad light, and then we get, like, the caller that just came on saying that this one event and all these things that are, you know, corresponding of it, you know, kind of goes against the whole entire, like, we're headed to this Armageddon.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Nora, it's one thing, Mike saying, I think, for a Navy SEAL to talk about these issues within the military justice system, but it looks like some may have been talking to the press. Is that a problem?
This whole issue raises a very profound question about the proper scope of civil-military relations, the relationship between the military and its political overseers. We have civilian control over the military in this country for a reason. We want the military to be held in check by those that we elect to the nation's highest offices. But again, that the boundary of where and when political leaders should intervene in the system is not cut and dried, although the authority is, you know, where the appropriate line is, where military leaders should be allowed to discipline their forces themselves versus having political interference in military decisions. And again, I think that's one of the reasons this has been so controversial and why you're hearing such discussion about it is because the norms of where the proper balance is in that relationship between the military and its civilian overseers is being contested and being pushed by the president in ways that no president has done before.
In our last minute, the Daily Beast is reporting that two officials have confirmed that the president wants the service members he pardoned to campaign for him. The Washington Examiner reporting that Gallagher's lawyer says he would endorse the president and campaign on his behalf if asked to do so by the president. What do you make of this if it bleeds over to campaign 2020?
I think it's a terrible precedent to have any military officer who has any notoriety, such as those pardoned in these cases, or any general officer or Navy admiral to be endorsing candidates one way or the other, precisely because it sends a message of politicization. It suggests that there are certain leaders in the military who endorse one political party or another. That has many, many negative effects on how civilian elites view their military advisors, and it fundamentally undermines the tradition of the military as a nonpartisan institution. I think it would be very dangerous if these individuals did this, and I think it's also a terrible idea for any retired generals and admirals who are public figures whose names are in the press to do so as well.
Nora, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Nora Bensahel is a visiting professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. She joined us today to talk about the controversy at the heart of a case involving a Navy SEAL, the president, and the U.S. military discipline system. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, is there such a thing as a slow news day? Our guest picked a random day in the 1980s and found out that any given Sunday can tell a lot of amazing stories. Hear the history of one day in the United States. There are a lot of myths and misconceptions about women and hormones. Meet the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. Plus, we'll get the latest on the impeachment inquiry and our roundup of the latest news in national politics. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate's guest says we can get a lot out of life by talking to strangers. Join the conversation with some strangers, maybe. We all know Kate, though. And share your experiences. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, when you're on a plane, is it okay to recline your seat, take off your shoes, trim your nails? We'll talk with an etiquette expert who has some timely advice for travelers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.